You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network. Visit jabberjawmedia.com for more shows like this one.
That's right. That is right. We're about to get this motherfucker going. Welcome to the X-Man Podcast. I'm your host, Doc Coyle. I appreciate you listening, sharing, and being here with me. What's going on with me? I'm on a little break. Yes. Battle's just finished our headline tour, co-headline tour, across the U.S., and we have about a week off at home, and it's been a little weird. Time off is weird. You know, I think I'm kind of going through, I'd say a bit of miniature depression, you know, like being depressed, but just for like one night. And I don't know. I think what happened is kind of coming off the road, you know, for the last 6-7 years of my life, being off the road was the norm. And now my life is kind of transitioning to back where being on the road is the norm. And I guess in a sense, this transition is a little scary, because I remember being a young man and being reliant and being, you know, being institutionalized by the beats, you know, of that, and kind of, you know, and I guess I'm a little scared about getting too caught up in that, you know, because it's not totally the day-to-day reality. I don't like my domestic skills to be atrophied in any way. So I don't know, it's kind of made me a little concerned. And I think things are evolving with regard to the popularity of the band, and with that, the way people have been treating myself and other members of the band. And for me, that's been a weird thing, because I've kind of more or less been at the same level of notoriety or fame for, you know, 10 years, 15 years. And with that said, very minimal. But enough that I could go out to a bar or a show, and people would come up and say hi, and it was really cool. And it's just generally people being pretty nice to you. But this is kind of, it's getting different, you know. We're doing VIP meet and greets, and people are crying, and they're making us things, and you know, very, you know, once I think a band gets to a certain level and you're on the radio and you're in all these different bigger environments, you know, it definitely changes the way people treat you. And it's making it a little bit more difficult to just walk around the show or just, you know, do certain things. So, and I don't want it to seem like I'm complaining, but it's kind of made me think about, you know, not be careful what you ask for, but that there are trade-offs with these things, especially when you choose to go into a profession that comes, you know, if you're successful in that profession, it comes with this other types of attention, you know. So it's it's something I'm kind of working through. And it's kind of funny, because I've been thinking about the idea of, you know, back in the day when I would tour, it, you know, the more kind of rock and roll lifestyle I enjoyed, and that means going out and getting, you know, partying after the show and hooking up with girls and kind of just being that person, fed into your ego, which in a way made you more of a performer, right? Like if I'm on stage, I could do some, you know, lick my guitar or start humping the monitors or something, because you're just wrapped up in it. And it's not really like, you could never lick the guitar or hump the monitors, but your ego could, this persona you built. And I spent so many years of my life deconstructing the persona and finding the person, it's almost difficult to kind of re-find that person. Not that I should, but in a weird way, when you're in a big band, people kind of want you to be a character, something larger than yourself. And it's something I'm struggling with, you know, like how do I kind of do the job well? Because I think there's a certain sense of going, you know, to see a band and it's kind of boring, or the, you know, the band, they don't necessarily meet your expectations of what you want to be wowed and you want to be presented. So I guess I'm trying to kind of find a way to authentically be a person and also do the job of entertainer, which is kind of, you know, it's something I do take seriously. You know, I think sometimes you get this thing with artists, you know, specifically musicians, where they just want to be a musician and they don't necessarily want to cater to the entertainment side of things, or maybe the visual side of things, or the showman side of things. And ultimately it hurts them. It hurts their career because they want to do it, but they want to do it on their own terms, which I can respect. Like, I think there's definitely many ways to go about this. There's not one way to do it. But in the world I'm in, I think not paying attention to that is just being a little short-sighted and a little lazy. And I want to do the best job possible for the situation I'm in. So I don't know. I guess I've just been going through a lot of different emotions and thoughts, because the things that are happening are new and it's expanding. And guess what? It's going to be continuing. I just found out we have dates booked through the end of the year. And this train is going to keep on rolling. I definitely want to give a shout out to From Ashes to New and Diamante, who were on the tour. Thank them so much. They were really great. And who else? I need to shout out some people. Who I need to shout out? I need to shout out Mike Mowry from Jabberjaw Media, you know, for helping push this show forward. I also got to shout out ESP Guitars. I just picked up a new guitar yesterday. If you follow me on social media, you will see my new guitar. ESP has been great, and I'm really excited to play this damn axe. What else? Oh, actually, a recommendation. There's a new podcast hosted by Blasco, and it's Blasco, who is the bass player for Ozzy, and he's played with Rob Zombie and all this stuff. And he has another, him and Mike actually have a podcast called Managemental, which is like music industry podcast. But then he just put out like a whole season at one time of a new podcast called A New Level. And it's got a few alumni, people that have been on the X-Men show, like the lawyer, Eric German, and who else? Somebody else is on there. But anyway, I just been listening to that, and I've really been enjoying that. So definitely check out A New Level. It's part of the Jabberjaw podcast family. And what else is going on? There's no sponsor this week. You know, you fucking guys, you sons of bitches, you know, trying to keep the lights over here. My kids can't eat. You know, got rats crawling on me. You know, that's what happens. You guys don't sponsor the show. You know, so that's why I've turned in such a poor performance today, because I was like, there's no sponsor. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, I guess there wasn't a sponsor this week. You know, a lot of people have been reaching out, but sometimes they don't come through. But that's all right. You know, we don't need to sponsor this week. It's all right. But next week we can have a sponsor. So guys, holla at me. Remember, I had too many sponsors. Now I don't have enough. So you can reach me. You know how to get in touch with your boy. Hit me on Instagram, hit me on Twitter, Facebook, or drop an email at thexmanpodcast@gmail.com. And you know how I got to do. I got to shout out this show's other sponsor, you know, not the band sponsor, but just I guess so technically we do have a sponsor. We just don't have a band musical sponsor. Our sponsor, rockabilia.com. They are the bomb. I wonder if they'll use that as like a tagline. It's like, rockabilia.com, we are the bomb. And they're like, what are you from, like 1995? And they're like, nah, man, that's now. Currently, we are the bomb. And people are like, man, that's kind of corny. And Doc probably shouldn't have said that. But anyway, rockabilia.com, you know the shit. If you listen to the show, you know the deal. They have all the band merch. All the band merch. I went over to the warehouse. I picked me up. I don't think that's proper English, but that's all right. I picked myself up a Muse t-shirt. It's white, it fits well, you know, fits my frame, you know, makes my shoulders pop, bam, pectorals, bam, looking good. And then I'm rocking one of my favorite bands, Muse. So they have a sick Muse shirt. And then you know what else I got there? I got me a sick ass Aliens shirt. And I was supposed to get it for Tommy from the band, but then he couldn't fit it. So then I kept it, and then it fits me pretty good. So that's what you do. I don't know what they call this. Not a re-gifter. It's like a fake gifter. You give someone a gift, but you hopefully they give it back to you. Boomerang gift. That's what I did. I boomerang gifted that shit. Anyway, head over to rockabilly.com. Pick up some stuff. Tell them Doc Coyle sent you. We got a Bad Wolves exclusive t-shirt over there. Use the discount code to get 15% off of your order. And that discount code is PC Jabberjaw. Again, that's PC Jabberjaw. Bam. Now let's talk about our guest real quick. It is one of my favorite humans in the world. Her name is Melissa Cross. If you're not familiar with Melissa Cross, she is a world famous vocal teacher and vocal coach. And she became famous like 10 years ago because she put out a DVD called Zen of Screaming, and she ended up training a lot of the heavy metal singers from our scene that, you know, my old band, God Forbid, came up with. So Dallas and Byron worked with her, Jesse Leach from Killswitch, Brian Fair from Shadows Fall, Randy Bly from Lamb of God. And she also taught me as well, kind of after the fact. And she's just one of these people that just radiates incredible energy. And I just and she's just amazing to work with and has taught me so much. And definitely someone I've had on my radar as far as wanting to get on the show for quite some time. So even if you're not into, I guess, musical instruction or anything like that, I think this is really fascinating because she is such a unique person. She's a gem. So I think you guys are really going to enjoy this conversation. Please check this out. My talk with Melissa Cross.
Down here?
Yeah. That's right. I get to have some actual proof of the quality of the greatest vocal timbre.
Oh boy.
In the five boroughs.
Me.
I guess does Long Island, that's not a borough, right? That's just like Long Island's Long Island.
Long Island. I used to think I needed a passport to get to Long Island.
So Melissa Cross, welcome to the X-Men.
I am honored.
I know your time is limited, so I guess we'll have to just like get into it. No, we can't warm up. We can't.
I warmed up already.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, people probably don't think of me as a vocalist, but
I do.
You taught Byron and Dallas from God Forbid, mm-hmm. and they ended up being in your DVD Zen of Screaming.
And you were actually in the doorway. There's one scene where you actually come into the doorway and say, hey.
Was that at Ozfest? On the bus?
It was on the bus, yeah.
But was it at Ozfest?
Oh my God, I think so. Because I actually wasn't on that bus. That was Denise Kariki.
Okay.
That was
then it probably was Ozfest because she came out for a little bit. But yeah. But anyway, so then you, since they were on the DVD, you said, listen, I'll teach you for free since it's like a family package, you know, since they were on the DVD. And I was like, if you say so.
Yeah, it's a family package.
You know,
and we are a family.
Yeah. I mean, so that DVD, I guess, is that your modern claim to fame? Is that how most people know you publicly?
I think most people know me because I'm one of the few people that addressed a certain kind of phonation that a lot of people don't want to touch. I know how long it took me to figure it out. So I think the DVDs have been extraordinarily successful. I would never have dreamed.
By the way, I bought it for my girlfriend for, I think, Valentine's, one of the Christmas, because she was like, oh, I want that, and I bought it for her.
Why did you buy it? I would have sent it
because
to you.
Because you got to support, you know?
Okay, well, I bought some t-shirts from you, so there you
go. Yeah, you got to support, you know? It's like, you know, let's say this, if your friends are doing something, you know, never feel bad about buying a ticket or a CD or a t-shirt. You know,
I agree.
I appreciate voting with my dollar.
I agree. In fact, I even bought a ticket for Bad Wolves for an extra ticket the other night.
See that?
I have no problem with it, and I appreciate the passes. Thank you. It was a great show.
Oh, thank you.
It was an awesome show.
Thank you. Thank you very much. But yeah. So So you offered that to me, and so we got to do a few lessons. That's, I guess, how we became friends and became close. I just, you know, you're like my spirit animal. I was saying to Liz, I was like, I need like a Melissa Cross like totem, and I'll just pray and I'll pray to it when I get up in the morning.
I need a totem too, but who could I don't want to use myself.
Who's your hero? Hey, Kanye probably has like a picture of himself and a statue, and wow, he prays to it.
I don't think I could handle that.
Yeah.
My heroes right now are scientists.
Okay.
They're people that deal with acoustics and vocal mechanics. And of course, my heroes are everybody that's stuck in the metal thing all this time.
Yeah, so let's actually go back a little bit, because I don't really know a lot about your background and where you started. I mean, I know you have limited time, so we can't, you know, we'll have to do the abridged version of, okay. But you're from New York?
No, I was born in Texas.
What part?
San Antonio, Texas.
No shit.
Yes, and I left there when I was 13 years old and went to the Interlochen Arts Academy.
What's that?
That is a boarding school for music, art, theater, and dance in northern Michigan. It's a high school, but it's a boarding school. And I knew from the time I was a small child that I was a performer. And I was kind of a spooky chick.
Spooky? Like, were you like goth before goth?
Yes.
Doing witchcraft? Summoning demons?
Well, I was wearing armbands and, you know, anti-war stuff. And, okay, you know, that was, you know, I was very...
Hippie? Post-hippie?
Hippie up. It was hippie. I am 61 years old. So we're talking 1966. Okay.
The genuine article.
I am the genuine thing. So anyway, I was always a performer, and I didn't have a lot of friends at school.
How is that possible? You seem very agrarian, you know, was it with the word agrarious?
Gregarious.
Gregarious.
Yes. I have word finding problems all the time. So you'll probably have to find one for me. But anyway, so I wasn't cheerleader. I just wasn't popular. And I was very introspective and deep. And then I had some trauma going on, you know.
Family drama? Trauma, I mean?
I was going to come right out and say it. I was, wow, this is hard. Okay, I didn't know if I was going to go here today, but okay. So I was raped, okay, when I was young. And so I went sort of sideways because I kept it a secret, and I had a lot of internal dialogue, but I was also really artistic. So I was very poetic, and I played piano, and I loved to sing. So when the 60s came up and this music was happening, I was in the mirror with a hairbrush doing it. You know, I was doing it, especially with Janis Joplin. Mm-hmm. Janis was my hero. So I realized I wanted to be a singer. But I didn't think it was something you did for a living. It was something that you did because that's what you did. And my parents said, well, if you want to be a singer, you have to learn how to do it properly. So they took me to singing lessons. And of course, it was all opera. So I studied opera. I studied classically. And I continued to study piano. I started piano when I was 6. I started ballet when I was 6. I mean, I was very dedicated as a performing artist with all the classical ways of doing things. So I begged them to send me to school, and I kept running away from home until they did. And they said,
Before the performing arts school.
Yes. Okay. I ran away from home so many times that they said, okay, fuck it. Just go.
Do kids still run away from home? I feel like that was a very like pre-internet thing.
Well, they, you know, I think
because if they leave home, there's no internet connection. There's no Wi-Fi at the bus station.
You know what? You're absolutely right. I never would have left Wi-Fi. That is such a, wow. I never thought about that. Well, there was no Wi-Fi, no. But anyway, I finished Interlochen, and I was a theater person, you know? I went to acting school in the United Kingdom because I was 16 when I graduated. I graduated a year early, and Juilliard wouldn't take me. I was too young. And the best acting schools are in England, yes, right? So I went to England and I got in.
So you studied like Shakespeare. Yeah.
Shakespeare. And I continued.
So you did all the right things. It's like classical piano, opera, Shakespeare. You have all the good.
I did all that stuff, but I was playing guitar.
Yeah.
And I was writing songs, and I was doing the rock thing, but I didn't think that you made a living. That was me. That was my life. That wasn't my profession. That was my identity. So I never even considered that music, that kind of music, was something you made a living at. It was so ingrained. Like, really understood counterculture. The 60s was counterculture. There were them and there was us. And us was peace, love, understanding, no war, no guns. Like, I was so dedicated to that. I was anti-war. And the songs that I listened to were anti-war. And this is why I relate to metal. Because this is why I got into music. Because metal is an identity. It's not a commercial commodity.
Well, I say it's the only, like, I don't believe in tribalism, but it is the tribe I chose.
It is the tribe that you are.
Yeah.
It's, well, it's, no, it I, chose well, you.
Well, to it, you're probably right. But what I'm saying is that it was feeling like I didn't have a place.
Yes.
In this realm or this realm where I was like, oh, these are my people. This is my thing. This is how I, where if I would have any identity, it's probably not a racial identity. It's probably not a religious identity or even a country identity, right? Like, you know, nationalism, it's more like, well, no, the, if I meet a someone who likes Slayer, who's from somewhere else, I feel like we have more in common than
that's
maybe,
your peeps.
Exactly.
That's your peeps. And so fast forward to the late 90s, I'm at a place that is now Webster. Well, I don't even know what that place is, but it was called The Ritz. And it was a show with Megadeth, Slayer, and I believe it was either the False Prophets or the Bad Brains. But I'm in the balcony and I'm looking down and I'm seeing all these kids moshing and I'm going, what the? What? Oh my God, it's, oh my God, this is so awesome. Look, they all, they know, the, they do, they, oh my God, this is, then I thought, oh shit, I'm too old. I can't do this. Shit.
That's so I just, first off,
well, I
true.
Was really much, I mean, I felt like.
I feel like right now, all right, so you ever listen to Jamie Josta's podcast?
Yeah.
At all?
Yeah, yeah.
So Jamie's the king of the pitch, right? The pitch. So I have an idea. And I was like, it's because the question I was going to ask was, so you just kind of skipped from the 60s and everyone's a hippie to the 80s and there's mosh pits. But all this time, you didn't, did you, were you a performing artist? Were you a recording artist?
Oh my God, yes.
So what was it? What was it under a band? Was it under your solo?
Okay, so let me go back. Okay, so I finished acting school, the old Vic Theater School, which is very hard to get into. And I finished it and at the end of it, I realized I was a character actress. So at that time, there weren't that many parts that were character for young women. And in England, if you wanted to be an equity in the union, basically you had to like work for a theater company that had two cards to give out, provisional cards. And usually they chose ingenues. They chose, you know, pretty skinny girls and handsome men to like carry spears or hold bouquets. And I was the kind of actress that does Nurse from Romeo and Juliet or Anfisa from Chekhov. Like I'm a character actress. I was not an ingenue. So I was like, you know what? I love to play guitar. I love to sing. And I got a standing ovation at school for doing a performance, right? And this is a really funny story. I got to tell you this. So I sing, like I've been taking voice lessons and this guy from New York comes, he's got a musical that he's workshopping and he's using students at the school to workshop this musical. He gives me this song and I sing it. I go, it's wonderful to feel. He goes, no, 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 don't sing it like that. Just sing it. I go, I am singing it. He's like, okay, well, just don't put that stuff in it. I was like, what stuff? He said, try it again. I was like, it's wonderful to feel. And I go, no, it's not like that. No, 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 just let the words out. I go, I am letting the words out.
You didn't know how to not put English
not,
on it.
I did not know what that
sauce
hell.
On it.
So he gave me a Karen Carpenter record. Okay. Now, I don't know if you know who Karen Carpenter is, but a very famous 60s band. And she has this, just like me, they long to be close to you. Very airy voice, right? So I imitated it, right? And I did his song the way that sounded. And I thought for sure I was going to make an absolute fool of myself. And I got this roaring standing ovation. I was like, okay. I felt like a dead person. When I was like, corpse. Like there was no energy. But I just, okay, if this is what I'm supposed to do, this is what I'm supposed to do. So I said, to hell with acting. I'm going to be a rock star, right? So I said, in 10 years, I am going to live in LA, Nashville, and New York, and I'm going to be a superstar, okay? But I got close, but I had a drug problem.
Really?
Whoops.
Okay.
Okay. So turns out I'm a heroin addict, but you know.
So you just got caught up in it.
Well, that drug was just perfect for me, because there was a lot of stuff that was bothering me that I wasn't really able to process, and so it was perfect.
Was now is that reflective of what was going on at the time, culture, or is that something personally that you found?
Both. Because you know, drugs were drugs; they were around, and it was kind of hip, and certain people shouldn't do drugs because certain people like me have an allergy that can't stop.
Did you go into like a program and do the whole
eventually
AA thing?
But it was, you know, when I moved to LA, I was in the whole punk scene, and like, oh, so in England, right, I stayed in England for a while after acting school, and that was, you know, 1977-78. So this is the Sex Pistols, 999, the Stranglers, you know, like this is the beginning. I mean, Elvis Costello was just, you know, this was the beginning of punk, right? And I was like, whoa. Now I was like sort of acoustic kind of, you know, hippie dress kind of thing, but I was very enamored. When I got to LA, I worked for a record store, and I ran away from like, okay, so there's this big chunk of thing where I came home and they tried to commit me to a mental institution. I ran away, ended up in a mental institution in LA, like eloped with an orderly, got into a rock band with the orderly, you know, got a job on Hollywood Boulevard at Peaches Records, started the new wave section on Hollywood Boulevard at Peaches Records, met all the punks, like, and we're talking punks, like these are not, I mean, the punks back then was like the Blasters and the Plugs and Circle Jerks and Dead Kennedys and like, and in fact, Belinda from the Go-Go's used to come in regularly and buy my, you know, import 45s of like punk stuff because I knew all those bands in England. So I had a whole section and I met all these bands. I was in a punk band. So I did the whole punk thing. I also worked for a record mogul, so I booked bands in this club, so I was very, but I was also addicted.
Yeah.
So, but I managed to keep my crap together, but I became the lead singer of a band in LA, and we played in that scene, but then-
are we talking late 70s, early 80s?
We're talking early 80s now.
Early 80s.
No, well, I actually ran away from home to New York to get away from the drugs. That's funny, right? So I left LA. A band member followed me and wanted to marry me, right? So there's all this like personal stuff.
What was the name of that band?
The Limit.
The Limit.
The Limit.
Is it out? See, I always get people, we have these old bands are in like, oh, is it out there? Is it on Spotify? Like, I don't know.
No. It's not on Spotify.
Hidden.
Okay, so eventually it was picked up by this guy in England called Simon Napier Bell, who managed the Yardbirds and managed Wham. And he put it out, but he took the band off and put on this like Top of the Pops kind of disco kind of vibe to it. So he just took the vocal off. So it was kind of a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, like 4 years in New York, I became the next big thing. Like I was-
As a solo artist.
As in a band. The band in New York was called BB Wamoto.
Say it again?
BB Wamoto. It's
BB Wamoto.
BB Wamoto was like Swahili for woman of fire.
Because you have red hair.
It's the same hair.
It's just.
The hair didn't change. The hair is the same. It's been the same all the time.
You have like some of the best hair, I think, that just exists in life.
Thank
it's
you.
Very exciting.
It wakes me up every morning. So anyway, I did this showcase for. It was Chrysalis, Warner Brothers, and Columbia. They were all there. And I bombed. I had a really heavyweight lawyer. I had a heavyweight manager who one of them has passed.
So you did a showcase?
Yes, it was a label showcase.
So what does that mean you bombed? That mean you sang poorly or you didn't bring energy?
I was in the middle of a horrific detox, right?
That's bad timing.
It was bad timing and I was impatient. Because we had been courted by this label for 9 months mm-hmm. and they wouldn't get off the pot and they kept throwing money at demos and they wouldn't like make the decision to like, you know, put it out. And I was like, I'm doing this showcase. And my lawyer was like the kind of lawyer that, you know, is that represents every A&R guy in town, right? So they all showed up, including the New York Times, including the New York Times. So I had no voice. I had somehow figured out how to put some neon on the stage that exploded on the first song.
It's a good thing I wasn't your manager. I'd be like, I have some heroin for you. We're gonna clean you up real quick, get you right for this show.
I'm telling you,
we got money to make here, young lady. Can we get some? Can we get our heroin guy? We're just gonna pump her just for the day.
Just for the day.
We're gonna re-detox. We're gonna get you back on track.
And on top of that, I had like a steroid shot because I had lost my voice. Right, so the steroids made me crazy. It was so horrific. And
so what was the fallout from that? Just everything dried up?
The New York Times wrote an article in the business section. It was called A Day in the Life of an A&R Guy. And it was at my showcase. And it said, had she paused for breath or had she mercifully finished? Quote, yep, she's finished. All right, said Jeff Aldrich, who, by the way, signed Disturbed. She's finished. All right. Like, I'm done. And everybody read that. And I was blacklisted and I ran away. And I ran away and I stayed in the home of Morgan Walker.
Oh, Morgan Walker, the publishing guy?
Rest in peace. Morgan Walker has passed. Okay, so Morgan Walker.
Yeah, we did a deal. God forbid did a deal with him.
Oh, I know. I know all about it.
Yeah.
So that's a very interesting story because.
Hey, I still get checks from Bicycle Music. I can't complain too much.
Okay, well, that's good that you get checks from Bicycle Music. Some people didn't get their checks. And that was a very, I have like some very sad mixed feelings about Morgan Walker. We were very close. He went to Interlochen, the place that I went to school. Mm-hmm. So we were close friends in school.
By the way, can I just say this for the record, that Morgan Walker looked like Ben Franklin? Rest in peace.
Morgan was an idealist and a hippie. Morgan Walker like recorded a lot of bands.
Yeah, I mean, I had
sound. He drove you around. Yeah. He fed you. He did all this stuff. And his idea was there was this utopia, this metal utopia, and it was going to be this great empire with publishing royalties and insurance and he had this idea that he was going to build an empire just for musicians.
Yeah.
And so he signed everybody's publishing and wouldn't let it go when major labels wanted to have it.
Yeah.
So he got really blacklisted, like big time. And he is a sensitive guy.
Well, I remember it was us, Candiria, Shadows Fall, Hatebreed, a lot of the
Keep going.
Oh, I'm saying
Killswitch.
Kills.
I mean, big bands. Yeah. We're talking big bands. And so he would not let go of that publishing, and the labels like blacklisted him. He got accused of pedophilia. Like, I mean, he just like completely collapsed.
So you were living with Morgan just.
I was a waitress on Route 7, right?
Okay.
Just like trying to, you know, and I built myself back. I got into recovery. I got sober.
Yeah.
Okay. So then what happened was I became a very confessional kind of artist because when you get sober, you get honest.
Yeah.
And I told a lot of stories with my acoustic guitar, right? So I didn't have that Susie and the Banshees kind of like mystique, you know, the makeup and the leather. I didn't have all that stuff.
You were stripped down.
I was stripped down, acoustic guitar. Hi, I'm Melissa. I wrote this song about blah, blah, blah. And I got really close then, but I remember the guy from Elektra. He said, you know, she's got a great voice. She's got some good songs, but she's too much like the girl next door. I was like, you know, I was like the bridesmaid at a million weddings. And then finally, I always had a day job. And I hated my day job.
Waiting tables?
I was a assistant. I mean, I was a executive assistant. I was a secretary. I was a legal secretary before to like music lawyer. So I know a lot about music legal stuff.
Yeah.
But I was also like a secretary to like these sleazy business guys that like, you know, like chasing me around.
Some madmen shit?
Yeah, bad stuff. Like chasing me around the desk and, you know, just really.
Chasing?
Yes. There was a lot of like sexual harassment, but I don't know. I still am not sure if I was complicit because of my issues, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. That's another story.
Yeah. That's anyway, like a whole other podcast.
It's a whole other podcast going on because I left the day job because I realized that I'm all about love and I need to love everything that I do in every moment, even if it's brushing my teeth. I'm not going to the office. I'm going to sing every day if it kills me, right? So I went and I I went in the subway and started singing, and almost within a week, somebody discovered me and picked me up and took me to Tommy Mottola. And like,
you know what your problem was? You were popping before YouTube. So you would have been a viral video.
I would have been a viral video. I swear to God. I swear to God. But anyway, let's fast forward, because in 1999, I had the band that I did the music that I was so proud of, and I'm still proud of it to this day. It's timeless. It's like, it still works for me. And I wanted to be a mom.
Yeah.
And hey, I'm getting to be like 40 something, right? And mm-hmm. I always wanted to be a mom. So I said, you know, I'm gonna do the mom thing, right? So I did the mom thing, and all of a sudden, like, performing, and I was already teaching, because when I went out in the subway, somebody said, I want to learn how to do that. Teach me how to do that. And I needed the money.
Now, what's that? Were you...
What I was singing. Talking?
Okay, you were singing.
I was singing. And someone said, will you teach me? And I said, sure, because I needed the money.
Well, then, same thing with me. I started teaching guitar because people asked me, not because I was trying to be a teacher.
But I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it. I loved it just as much as performing, because I thought, wow, I know a lot about this.
Yeah.
I could do this.
So all your vocal stuff, is this stuff that you put together from your classical training,
yeah,
like that you're basing on that, and then in addition to stuff you had learned on along the way?
Exactly.
Or are you just teaching your original stuff you learned?
No, there's stuff I've learned along the way.
Yeah.
Because first of all, as a performer, you learn a lot more than you learn in a classroom.
Yeah.
However, I have a lot of, you know, I pride myself in integrity, and I do not want to teach something that would do any harm. Mm-hmm. So I studied my butt off on this, because like, once I got, you see what happened to me when I was singing at CBGB, I had The Limit played, I mean Bibi Wamoto played CBGBs, and I was screaming, right? But it wasn't the kind of screaming that's happening now.
Well,
but
like
I was
punk screaming kind of style.
Yeah, punk. Yeah. Yeah, but I was like, shut up.
So is that band out there? Where because I want to know. Listen, I want to know
it all.
I want to know where the Melissa Cross solo albums are buried. It's like with
they're in my garage somewhere.
Jimmy Hoffa's next to his skull somewhere.
I have some.
Okay.
Maybe I will put
but
it
by
up.
The way, this is what I was talking before about the pitch, the Jamie Joss, the pitch.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that I was like, I want to do a record with Melissa Cross singing.
Oh, that would be, I would love to do that.
You know, I want to, you know, because if it's not out there, I want to be a part of it. Help, you know, I would love to do music with you.
I would love to do that. And you know, people have asked me, like, why don't you do this? And I was like, because I don't have anything to wear.
You don't have anything to wear.
I have nothing to wear.
I don't want to hear these darned excuses. How dare you?
So anyway,
if I brought you some music, would you think about it?
Yeah, you do some changes. I'll write a song right off the bat.
Okay.
I would love that.
All right, the thing is, now that I put it on wax, now I have to follow through.
You know, I would so love that. That kind of makes my day, because I love doing that. I mean, I help other people do demos and stuff.
Getting to train with you and just see how you just have this, like I said, how you can just mimic someone or show this thing, and just the control. Because, you know, it's one thing to be able to teach it, but then be able to just do it. I'm like, I want some just off the top Queen, nine octaves.
I don't have nine octaves. Nobody does. But
listen, I'm just throwing words out there that don't make sense. It's called hyperbole. Try and keep up.
Okay. I'm from Texas. I should know that. But I wanted to tell you that when I was doing the Bibi Wamoto thing, I got injured and I was on vocal rest. And during vocal rest, I started getting into vocal science because I wanted to heal myself because I didn't want surgery. So I learned a lot about, like, the most that I learned. I learned the most from theater school, from acting school, from the Shakespeare stuff, because really what I'm teaching is a classical version of speaking. It's not classical singing. It's classically affected spoken word.
Okay.
So I somehow put those two together. Like I got it. Like the lights went off. And I realized that good technique is not something you throw out the window to sound real. There is a correlation between speaking, like Yeah. And I can sing above the pencil too, but I'm not going.
Ee-ee. Do you want to explain what above the pencil means?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, that's okay. So above the pencil is a head trip. Just like golfers have a swing thought, above the pencil is a head trip. And it is a head trip that is epitomized, if that's a word, by exercises where you feel resonance in your face. Mm-hmm. So if you go like that, you feel your ears buzzing, you feel your face buzzing. And when you pretend that you feel that, not actually feel that and not make that sound, but just pretend, like you're pretending you're a fireman when you're 4 years old. You pretend that you feel that, your body does a advantageous thing for singing. It lowers your larynx, it makes more space for resonance. And you've kind of, every time you hit the E vowel, it buzzes your skull.
Yeah.
And you've got like a resonant voice. This is a resonant voice. This is not a resonant voice.
So that's the
this
idea is a resonant of voice. Sounding, the idea of a voice being like nasal is like the non-resonant.
Okay, so it depends. They say nasal's.
Sometimes good.
Okay, well, no, because nasal's like one of those words.
Some people are like,
guys, nasal is like this, and nasal is bad, because nasal is making my larynx so high that there's no space in my throat, but it has nothing to do with my nose. Okay, so it's something, it's very complicated.
Can I kind of ask a question? This is like a theory of mine.
Yes.
About, because you talk about the like, you'll say, sing as you speak as you sing, right?
I don't say that.
You don't say that? Well, didn't you say something similar to that?
Well, some people say that, but I say, if you speak bad, don't do that.
Yeah. Well, or that it's the same technique.
I say be real.
Be real.
I say, like, try to phrase your lyrics and try to emote your lyrics as if you were speaking.
Yes.
But not the sound, unless you have a great speaking voice.
Yes.
It's not like do speaking sound. It's like be real. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, don't sing a song like this, but sing a song like that. You know, like.
Yeah. Well, the reason why I bring that up is the idea of, you know, I think it's interesting you have this acting background, mm-hmm. and theater background. Because I notice people who are great impressionists.
Yes.
Right? From like comedically, you mm-hmm. know, or actors. Usually 9 times out of 10, they're also really good singers. Like Eddie Murphy is a good singer, for example. Mm-hmm. But he's mm-hmm. a great impressionist. Like, mm-hmm. and they can do certain, and it's almost the same kind of idea of hearing a tone and then being able to match it. Or like a great singer who's able to do covers, and they can kind of match different. Oh, I can sound like Chris Cornell. I can mm-hmm. sound like, mm-hmm. you know, this person.
It is a neural connection.
Yeah.
It's definitely a neural connection. And some people have easier times with singing than others.
One Hit Thunder is a podcast where we both celebrate and have a good laugh about bands and artists that had just one hit that we all know. Each week, we're joined by a guest from the world of music or comedy to learn more than you ever thought you would about some songs that you can't forget. And we decide if they brought the one-hit thunder or were nothing more than a one-hit blunder. Look, if you listen to the show, you're probably going to laugh, and I guarantee you're going to crush next time the bar has music trivia. Tag Team, Jane Child, Meredith Brooks, Looking Glass, Sean Mullins, Eiffel 65, EMF, Crash Test Dummies, Crazy Town, Chumbawamba. We have hundreds of episodes in our back catalog and a new episode each week. So pass the Dutchie, make sure you're connected, and subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your pods.
Hey you, do you have any plans this year? How's that going? Did you get 2020? Well, welcome to a brand new podcast called 2020, where myself, Benny Goodman, and my good friends, Corey Pazin and Siobhan Cronin from the band Lost Symphony, also got 2020.
And since the world ended this year, we decided why not just check in with some of our friends in the music industry and see how everyone's doing.
We're going to get a candid look at life on and off the stage, as well as the mindset of some of the most successful people in the entertainment industry.
New episodes drop every Sunday and Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern.
And you can listen at 2020-D.com, SoundTalentMedia.com, or on your favorite podcast app.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series
about how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with.
The way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments. The ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember. The ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app.
And subscribe now.
You don't have to be born to do it, but it's easier for some to learn because of that neural connection.
Yeah.
And those neural connections are made when you're really small, when you're a baby. So, you know, if your parents are playing music in the house, you're much more likely. You know what I mean?
Okay, so I have to ask. So on the Bex, man, we always got to get a little racial on here because I love it. You know what I'm saying? I talk some black shit.
Okay.
So, all right. No, because there are still, okay.
Now, respect.
Now, this is a question, and you don't have to answer controversially either, but this idea, like, or maybe it's a stereotype that, like, black people can just sing.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if you go on, if you on record say anything.
Let me see. Okay. There is a physiology about the African American body.
Yeah.
That there is a register break that's not always there between the head voice and the chest voice. That is physiologically, I've noticed that as a teacher.
Okay, so what does that mean?
It means that you go from your lower notes to your higher notes without that crack.
Oh, so it's like, it's a smoothness, a transition.
It's a transitional smoothness. So it's called dampening.
Dampening.
It's like a sustained pedal.
Yeah.
From the,
or this idea that you can, and people say this, you know, that, you know, like I remember I was on tours with the guy from Nemec. He's like, when I hear you and your brother sing, he's like, you sound black. Or like the idea that there is a tone, you know, to, you know, that different, you know, your background or genetically that there's like people, different people from different parts of the world, different backgrounds have different tones. That's kind of fascinating.
That is true. There is some physiology.
Yeah.
But that's not to say that every black person can sing.
Oh, no. But, you know.
Like not all black people have good rhythm.
Yeah, listen, guys. Listen.
Some of them are pretty retarded.
We've seen Obama dance. A little stiff. Huh.
Yeah.
Listen, Michelle, I'm not that great at dancing. I'm trying to get it down. He actually can sing. Did you hear him do Amazing Grace?
Who?
Obama.
Oh, yeah, he's good.
Yeah, he's got it.
He's got it, because he went to church.
Oh, church is church.
Church is, a lot of people that go to church when they're kids, they can sing.
Yeah.
Because they understand letting go of a spirit.
Yeah, maybe it's not maybe sometimes it's difficult to extrapolate the culture from the genetic background, right?
For sure.
So maybe it is just that, you know, you think of the distinctly American history of slavery, of Jim Crow, of blues, of, you know, this slave music and all that pain and how that filtered into what was the kind of inflection point, that was religion and church and that.
Yes, but that's, yeah, now you got, you know,
that's salvation,
jazz, blues, R&B,
yeah,
rap. I mean that's all like that's genetic.
Yeah.
But it's cultural. It's also physiological. It's genetic.
Yeah.
But it's cool.
Yeah.
It's cool. It is. I think it's all for sharing. You know, it's all like, it doesn't matter who owned it. Let's just do it. You know,
yeah.
I don't have any objection to white rap.
No, but I just think it's fascinating because you'll have these people, whether it's Amy Winehouse.
Yes.
Or Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Yes.
Or what's the guy I did? Never gonna give you. Rick Astley.
Yeah, Rick Astley.
So, Rick, you know, this idea of
Ashford
the...
Ashford and Simpson.
But part of the reason why those people seem to be these phenoms is that if you weren't looking, if your eyes were closed, you would think that they were black. Like, they have this...
I thought Astley was.
No, he's the whole funny thing, he's got hair like you, and he's this, like, 6'2",
that's
pasty
amazing
white dude who has this... And he sounds like Billy Ocean.
And I did just... not know that, I swear. Oh, my God.
No, but there's this thing of, like, oh, they have that timbre and that richness and that soul. And it's kind of like Joss Stone sounds like
a black girl.
Yeah, it's insane.
Right? So, you know,
yeah,
I get it. It's all okay.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm about it. You know, I just, you know, it's just interesting how the correlation or maybe a lack of correlation between when we hear something and then the visual, you know, like how we have to kind of attach some visual
to it. Yeah, we do that. But the definition of creativity is taking two or more things that you already know and making something different.
Yeah.
That's the essence of creativity.
Everything is a remix.
Everything is a remix.
You ever see that video? Everything is a remix.
No, that's cool.
There's a fantastic video on the interwebs called, and it's basically a video essay about kind of deflating the idea of originality. That essentially, basically what you're saying, that all new ideas are two things that have already existed and put together, or multiple things put together, because nothing exists out of a vacuum. Everything comes from something.
Yes.
So the idea of originality, things that we think are original, we just actually may not know the source material or the influence. But if you go down the rabbit hole, you will see, oh, this thing you thought was the most unique thing in the world. No, you just didn't know that they were influenced by this guy in their town, or this rare record, or this, you know, Italian film that came out in 1920 or something. So, you know, I highly recommend everyone watch the video. Everything is a remix. It does a better job of explaining itself than I just did.
Well, God bless the World Wide Web.
Yes. There's a lot.
There was something new, by the way. You know, the internet. Yeah. The internet was something new. Like, remember, like, we only had answer machines that were like cassette tapes that... that you could put in your pocket and save for blackmail.
So moving forward a little bit with you teaching and stuff, when does the screaming technique start being developed, and and connectively, how do you start kind of hooking up with all these metal bands?
Okay.
Within that.
So Morgan Walker is recording these bands in Rock House Road in Wilton. And he calls me and says, I can't get these kids through a session without coughing blood.
Jesus.
Can you help? And I said, well, I'll try. So he brings, I can't even remember who it was. My second person that he brought was Jesse Leach.
Wow.
Right? The third person that was supposed to come that never did was Josta.
But by the way, was this Jesse when he was initially having problems?
No.
When he quit the...
This is Jesse before Killswitch was even assigned.
Oh, wow.
This is way before they were... This is when they're making demos in Wilton. So this first guy, he's... It's not coalesce. It's not coalesce.
Converge? Cave-in?
Dismay. That was the name of it. Dismay.
Why do I not know that band?
Dismay. Okay, so this band, this guy from Dismay, he starts and he screams and I go, okay. Like, I'll try.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to be embarrassed and say no for an answer. So what I did was I said, okay, I'm going to take some time with this. I took a week, I imitated it, and I figured out how to do it without hurting myself. Went to the doctor's office, put the camera down my throat, figured out what I was doing, and figured out exercises to teach.
I can see why your scientists are your heroes.
Because yes.
Because you basically performed the scientific method.
I've already went into science.
You reverse engineered.
I reverse engineered it.
Yeah.
So basically, I found a way to make that sound without the emotional impetus.
Yeah.
Okay. So I made the actual clinical noise, a sound effect, with my vocal folds, which sounded like...
So is that the same skill set that allows you to, is this like the imitation skill set of like, I hear something and then I can translate that? Is that part
well,
of it?
That's part of it. But then I had to translate it into something that's usable on stage, because I had to figure out how to do it quietly and then augment it with support.
Yeah.
With like breath pressure and like to equalize it.
And by the way,
learn about sound.
I was talking over you a little bit when you were doing, do that voice again, that little noise. And that's the kind of core of it.
That's one phonation, because I found out there's different kinds of screams. There's that one too. And there's woof, there's that one too.
What's
those are all that, three different ones.
What's like, the one that Byron does, you said that you're like, you could do that?
That one. That's called false chord. That's the ventricular folds.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. And that you need a certain amount of auxiliary diaphragmatic mechanics to make it so that it's not so abrupt. So you don't But Byron never got hurt.
No.
Because Byron's built like a brick shit house, right? Yeah. Oops, I said the bad word.
You can curse on here.
Okay.
There's no.
Oh, yeah, it's the World Wide
Web. There's no rules.
It's the internet.
You develop this technique, and then what happens next?
So then, you know how, what a family the metal thing is?
Yeah.
It still is. So Jesse, actually it was Jamie. He's the one that spread the word, and he never even showed up for his lesson. And I have to thank him personally one of these days because he told everybody he knew he was going to come and learn this, but he never showed up.
Can I give just a little opinion about his? It always seemed like he had really good technique because he always yelled with a pitch, which sounded to me like it was,
there was
he
was doing something right. I'm telling you, there was a couple of years where Jamie couldn't order dinner.
Oh, really?
Okay. I remember it clearly because I remember Headbangers Ball, and I remember this like, but that was, you know, that was a short-lived thing because he developed like scar tissue that, you know, he didn't really need, he figured it out, okay?
Yeah.
He didn't want to sing melodically. That wasn't his
thing. He eventually did, though.
Yes, but, well, you know what? God bless him. He figured it out. He's a smart
But he
dude.
Never went to you to,
never,
to sing melodically?
Never. Wow. He just did the greatest advertising ever because he told so-and-so and so-and-so told. So then came Brian, and then it was the Rev. The yeah. Rev.
Our manager.
Yes, your ex-manager, right?
X-Man alumni, he was on here.
Oh, cool. I love that guy.
You should listen to that episode.
Hamburger Man.
It's a good one, yeah. I don't know how he doesn't have the diabetes. Oh, I'm sorry, diabetes.
The diabetes. I love that guy. Anyway, so he brought all his clients because Morgan was tied up with him too.
Yeah.
So that's how it happened. Everybody told everybody. And then I had too many people. Then I realized I needed to do a service and I need to make a film so I could hand this film out because there were too many people that were coughing blood.
Yeah.
So I made it a service kind of video. And I did not mean to be well known for it. It just became big.
Yeah.
Like it's, you know, more than gold.
Gold, like half a million DVDs?
Well, I don't know how the DVD things works, but
oh,
it's
yeah,
sold.
Oh yeah, you don't have to sell, you sell less to be gold.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't even know what gold is, but I've sold over 200,000 copies of it.
Holy shit. So you're the queen of Scream.
That's what they say. I didn't make that up, but.
Well, the thing that's interesting is I trained with you, but we never worked on screaming, really. We only worked on singing.
We worked
singing.
On singing because yeah. you wanted to sing.
Yeah, I'm still working on
it. But I
could
teach you how to scream.
Yeah.
But you sing really well, but you're a perfectionist. So you are better than you think you are.
Yeah, well, I think I keep getting better, and the more I work on it, the better I get. I'm just, as a Renaissance man or quasi or wannabe Renaissance man, you realize you can't do everything all, like I'd rather be pretty good at 50 things than mm-hmm. amazing at two things, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Well, you could be amazing at a lot of things too.
Well,
you can't.
I'm
Kevin Bacon. He's a great singer, great songwriter. No one takes his music that seriously because he's such a great actor.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah. But well, you can be.
You're good.
Well, I'd say this. I've never put the focus on it to be like a quote-unquote lead vocalist or to be that person, even though I know I probably could.
Yeah, you don't have the lead singer disease anyway.
No.
It's a disease.
Well, no, I think in many ways, I think a lot of people become singers because they have something to say. Mm-hmm. And the things I have to say, I get out in a lot of other ways, whether mm-hmm. that's writing, whether it's this show.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes I don't need to express myself poetically mm-hmm. or like, all right, I have this emotion and I need to get it out via song.
Yeah.
You know, I don't necessarily have that impulse, but now I'm kind of moving to a different phase where I kind of want to see if I can do this. When I say singer-songwriter, I mean compose a piece of music with lyrics and melodies and then present it. Because up till now I've just done instrumental and then hand it off. But I want to challenge myself to see if I can do the full thing.
I've always been impressed with, like, when I first heard God Forbid, there was this brand new thing that I heard that you and Dallas used to do. You used to do these harmony, like,
guitars.
Instrumental thing, right?
Yeah.
And it was amazing to me. It was like classical music. It was on that level. It was very complex. It was like super complicated, like rhythmically and tonally, and it was pure, and it blew my mind. And I thought, this is so brand new. This is so brand new. And I always had, it had a very odd structure, but that was what was good about it.
Well, because we didn't have any background in theory. So everything was based on our ear. Or a lot of times, this is the thing about playing in a band with your brother, is a lot, so much stuff happened in the room.
Exactly.
So there's there's a song on Constitution of Treason called Divinity.
Yes. Right?
And there's this, the bridge in the song has this really, really cool chord progression where me and my brother are doing like octave chords.
Yes.
And we're doing, he's going left, I'm going right. And we never sat down and worked it out. We just started playing that and it just sounded cool. And I never even knew what he was playing until he left the band and I had to transcribe what was going on. And you see
see what genius it is.
Well, but it is this intuitive thing where something happens and then it's just a magical moment and you're like, that's great.
That's great art to me.
Yeah. And you just, well, yeah. And it's a kind of, and that's the idea of chemistry,
yeah. Right?
Like chemistry is very, you know, like with my other band, Vegas Nerve, the first time we ever got in a room, we just literally started playing.
Yeah.
Like dudes just started hitting the chord and I started doing a thing and singer started singing the guys. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, this is, and it was in 5 seconds. There was no kind of distinction that, and then when that happens, people went, oh, why didn't you just like start the, you know, get new players in Los Angeles? I'm like, because you can't buy.
Exactly.
You know, that's the band.
Exactly.
Those five guys are that band. The same thing with God Forbid. It's like those five guys were the band. You know?
I kind of depend on you to stay in that place because you say, you know, you want to like do a song from beginning to end. And I just like, that's, you know, we've heard that before.
No, but not from...
I don't want you to go like all conventional on me because...
It's not about a lot of these things you have to understand are also a function of necessity, right? The fact that when I'm doing Vegas Nerve and I'm working on material and the rest of the guys are across the country,
yes.
The option to just get in a room and jam on stuff isn't really there. So then, or if it's like, hey, I get a call from Mike Gitter. Hey, we need a song. Do you want to write a song for Body Count? I have to go in my toolbox and figure out how to do that on my own.
Did
and
you write a song for Body Count?
Yeah, I wrote on the last record.
Cool.
Yeah. Was it? This is, why am I forgetting the damn name of the song? This is Why We Ride.
Yeah.
Anyway, but being able to be self-sufficient, not saying that's my favorite thing to do because I love the collaborative experience. I miss getting in a room and just jamming and letting things happen. But it's good to develop that skill set in case it's necessary. It's more of just like a challenge. Like, can I do this?
Yes.
You know.
And I remember when you first started working with Tommy, I realized that Tommy was going that sort of radio place.
Yeah.
And he was lucky to have you like wouldn't like, you know, compromise it too much.
Well, but the thing is it didn't work the first time. The clashes were too much, which is why that project didn't
Well,
continue.
That's exactly right. But I'm glad you didn't give up because it's a good combination, the two of you.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, we're really going to see what Bad Wolves on the next record because I joined after most of the stuff was done and I contributed a little bit. But I'm so in awe of the work that they did that my thing was like, I don't want to, you know, throw anything in the pot that's going to ruin what's already happening. I have to interject myself in a way that's not obtrusive to the thing that they already figured out, you know?
Cool, and but now you can add that special doc thing.
I know, but a lot of musicians, especially people who've been the main guy of another band,
yes,
they come with that ego of like, I'm this guy, so I should be doing this. And it's like, I'm not bringing any of that. Cause that when you get too many like big heads in the room, this is why like the Beatles don't last and the Eagles don't last.
That's
like
right.
You get all these, you get three or four geniuses, not that I'm a genius, but when you get these heavyweights, they all want to go solo because they're so good.
Yes.
That it's difficult for them all to kind of occupy the same space.
You got to keep Vegas Nerve then.
No, I'm not stopping anything. That's cool. What I say. I never stop anything or end it. Even God forbid, I would do if the opportunity arose or something came up. I never throw anything out the door.
Like me, you guys gonna come back?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think there's much of a demand. To be truthful, you know, we're not getting calls. No one's, you know. But that's fine too. You know,
I'd be there.
Well, you know, who knows? You know, it's. But I think things. You don't want to. You know, sometimes not dwelling on something allows it to kind of exist in a way that's mm-hmm. better than being desperate of like, the main thing I don't want to do is be in the mindset of rekindling something that was happening. Let's be about today.
Yeah, exactly.
Even if I'm rekindling with those guys and doing something like, I have a song I wrote for Josta that he didn't use. And I'm like, this could be like, this probably should be a God forbid song, you know? And I was like, but I would be down just like, hey guys, you want to record like one song and just put it out or something? Like, I'm totally cool with whatever, but I never.
Let's you and me do it.
All right. All right. No, but what I'm saying is that I don't get in the kind of mental state of shutting off doors. I'm all about opening doors and creating opportunities, not closing things off. So yeah. So right now it just happened to be something that is very all encompassing. And it's just, we're on a roller coaster ride and we just got to keep taking it until it stops, you know.
It's hopefully, doesn't stop. Yeah.
We'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. But enough about me. See, you did that thing where you started interviewing me.
I can't help it.
Oh man! All right. Well, you know, I think that's, you know.
I hate to go, but my kid's gonna.
No,
graduate.
I know. It is perfectly fine. Listen, I think we got the general idea of the story, and you know, maybe we'll have to bring you back on and talk again when I can get you. Hey, apparently we're gonna work on some music, so now we'll be in each other's midst.
That
at some
would be
point.
Awesome.
Yes.
That would be so awesome. That
Melissa,
makes my day.
I love you. Where can people find the DVD?
Okay, so here's the news, right? The DVD at present is at melissacross.com, but melissacross.com. by the fall will be a subscription website that you can find out everything you need to know about speaking, singing, or screaming.
Right on.
It will be a community. You will pay one price, get everything that like up to date, like new content all the time, new webinars archived, guest artists. It's going to be awesome. And it's called See the Sound because I got something up my sleeve that nobody's ever done before. You know how I used to tell you, like, see the vowels across the venue? Like, you go, ma, and you see ahs go, ah, 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 ah. Well, I have an animator that has animated the warm-up. So abstract animation, z's, yayas, it's all in artistic, beautiful, multicolor form.
That's amazing because one thing about you, probably my favorite thing and what makes you such a great teacher is you're able to take something internal that we can't see and then you figure out ways of using metaphor and expressive language to make us visualize it. So I'm really looking forward to
this. This is the visual. This is it.
That's exciting.
This is it. It's pretty awesome. It's pretty awesome.
Right on. Well, Melissa, I love you. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Doc. I love you. I do.
Well, see, guys, I'm going to get emotional here. All right, we got to stop. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
How many times have you told me that things will get better, that things will be better someday? We'll all come together and things will be better. Things will be better. We'll be right back. bow down to the government, be slaves to the punishment. Someday we will live for a better man.
So that was a track entitled Never Enough from a band called COSM. That's COSM. And it's actually Ravi and Aiden from my other band, Vagus Nerve. It's a new project they've been working on for quite some time. And they just put that out. And the album is called Omniscient. And I think you can get that, you know, on pretty much any digital format. And those guys are so talented, and I actually just got to see them. I saw Aiden and Ravi in Lancaster, and then I saw Mike and Mo when I was in New York. Love all those guys. Hopefully we can work on something at some point. I'm just so damn busy, man. No time for nothing. But yeah, I just wanted to show you guys that because they good at music, and that record is really cool. So I hope you enjoyed that, and I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Melissa. She is the best, and I think that's pretty obvious from hearing the conversation. Anyway, I think that pretty much wraps it up for me. I'll be heading out on tour this week. Bad Wolves is opening a tour, what we call sheds or amphitheaters. And that's where there are seats in the front and then the open areas in the back, and it's outdoors. It's a whole thing. It's a whole summer rock and roll thing. But we'll be going out the tour. It's Nothing More, Playing Above Us, and then Breaking Benjamin and Five Finger Death Punch flip-flopping, I believe, as headliners. And I've done, you know, Ozfest and Mayhem Festival at those venues, but I was always on the side stage. So this will be the first time I'll be doing a tour like this where I'm on the main stage. You know what I'm saying, baby? Not called on the main stage, y'all. You know? Well, anyway, I had a donut, guys, and some extra coffee, so I'm a little pumped up, you know? It's all right. That's how you get a little donut in you. You know what's fucked up, too, is I probably have some cavities, and that's not good, and I'm going to be on the road for, like, 7 weeks. So it'll probably be a while before I get to my teeth probably checked out. So you know what? I might as well just go full bore and just eat more snacks while I'm on the road. But you know what? Quizzically, I've actually been getting myself in pretty good shape while I'm home. For whatever reason, I can get in better shape at home than when I'm on the road. I haven't figured that out yet. But you know, if you guys want to send me workout tips, if you want to send me places to get good donuts. I was lucky I got to go. I was in Denver, so I got some Voodoo Donuts, which was the bomb. And, you know, because rockabilly.com is the bomb. And, you know, just let me know what's going on, guys. You know, I'm going to be in Seattle for a day. I might try and get some interviews. I'm up there. Maybe Matt Wicklin, who was in God Forbid. Maybe Jeff Loomis from Nevermore. I don't know. I'm just throwing shit out there that I haven't even solidified yet. So I'll just put that in the universe. I just spoke with Dave Davidson from Revocation. Have an episode come out with him soon. I will be speaking with A.L. Levy, formerly of Doth, this week, currently of Unstoppable Recording Machine. So we have a lot going on. And the more I'm on the road, the shit's just going to keep popping up. This party don't stop. Anyway, guys, I love you very much. I will see you soon. Please, I hope to see you on that tour. BadWolvesNation.com for tickets. And, peace out, fool. Mamba out.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs, but what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone Magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.